It's an honor today to speak with Dr. William Martin. William is, well, among other things, he's a noted author and a speaker, and he's a senior fellow for religion and public policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston, Texas, and has written extensively for a number of publications. And his book, A Prophet with Honor, The Billy Graham Story, regarded as the authoritative biography of Billy Graham. And so we are going to spend some time talking with Bill about his reflections on the life of Billy Graham. William, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be with you.
So obviously, we have experienced the loss of this significant icon of evangelicalism and faith really across the globe. You had an opportunity, I know, to go to memorial service. I'm just interested in maybe your reflections as you look back, maybe some of the things that you heard talked about and reflected. Was there something in the tributes that maybe you wish had been mentioned, or aspects of Billy's life that weren't highlighted?
Actually, you know, the service was by invitation, and so pretty much everybody there, I think, already knew a great deal about Billy Graham's life. There was not much revelation in that. But what was heartening was to see so many people who had either worked with him and either part of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association itself over the years, or had cooperated with crusades or were friends and others. So it was in many ways a reunion. And although, of course, it's sad when someone dies and someone who is so well respected, but it's also the mood was not one of sadness, but of great satisfaction at this end of a truly significant life. He, of course, achieved a great deal more than most people ever think about achieving in a lifetime. He was probably the most dominant religious leader. Certainly no more than one or two popes, perhaps one or two other people, could come close to what he achieved with respect to religion. And as you indicated, he was the key leader and the major spokesman of the evangelical movement during the last half of the 20th century. And that's become one of the strongest of all world Christianity and world religion. And he played the major role, though not the only important role. And so people there knew that. And we're all going to die. And I think any of us would say, let me live to be 99 years old and have my mind intact. Yeah. And to be able to look back on a life in which I was able to do even more than I set out to do or dreamed I could do. So it was more a celebration of a truly remarkable life.
Well, and you have summed it up so well in your book, A Prophet with Honor, The Billy Graham Story, and this is an updated edition. It's just come out, and so we're honored to just review the story once again. I'm interested maybe a little bit about your background and relationship with Dr. Graham and those that are around him, because you were given the opportunity to write the book without conditions, and that allowed for some critique. So I'm just curious, maybe were there some areas that you did find reason to maybe question or scrutinize, and maybe what kind of reaction you got when you wrote?
In general, the reaction has been quite good. I mean, it was the organization itself considers it to be the authoritative biography, and in the last 2 weeks, as the book has been released, and I want to say, by the way, this was a coincidence. It was going to be released at this time anyway. It was to use the common parlance, there was no collusion.
Good.
With it being released in Mr. Graham's 100th year. But I've been working on it since the first edition came out in 1991, and I've worked since 2000 in updating it and keeping up with his ministry and life, bringing it up through the early part, through the inauguration of Donald Trump in 2017 and Franklin Graham's association with that. But I got started on this. My teaching was in the sociology of religion, and I was interested, been fascinated, and I talk about this in the introduction to the book. I've been fascinated with preachers, and as a matter of fact, one line I have is, I didn't hold any revivals myself until I was 14. So I was a boy preacher and preached for a number of years, although from the time I went to college, I wanted to become a college professor. After I finished my graduate work and came to work at Rice, I still was fascinated with the radio preachers and the television preachers, the electronic church, and wrote a good bit about that. And Texas Monthly Magazine asked me, the editor asked me to write a profile piece about Billy Graham. And so I wrote it in 1978. It appeared in early 1979. And that means that I have been on this case for 40 years. On the basis of that article, which was not a puff piece at all, but it was a fair article, and Mr. Graham liked it, and he wrote me two different letters saying he'd looking back on that and thought it was one of the fairest articles written about him. And then in 1985, he said, it's time in my organization, or it's time in my life to have someone from outside of my organization and essentially with the academic credentials to write a study to see about my life in ministry and its place in history, if any. And, of course, it had a place in history. So I undertook that and began writing about it. And you indicated that it's not there were no conditions. I wouldn't have accepted to write what's called an authorized biography, which means you just say whatever the subject wants you to write. And he made it clear right away that's not what he wanted. He said, I want you to look at warts and all, and we have some warts. And he trusted me to be fair about it. And he said, I don't even have to read it. But the several members, I said, I would want people on your staff that you trust to read it for historical accuracy. And they did that and went through it very carefully. And so the organization has been quite pleased that they never argued that there weren't any, that there were no, that there were historical, errors.
Sure.
As far as what I found, there were things, for example, most notably, that his relationship with the presidents, but particularly with Richard Nixon, President Nixon took advantage of him. And Billy Graham was such a trusting person and a trustworthy person that I think it was hard for him to believe that other people weren't so trustworthy. And I showed him things and found things in the Nixon archives and other sources where they were saying, here's the way we need to use Billy Graham. We need to do him to do these things. And it was just clear, we're going to use him. And I interviewed Charles Colson about that, and he said, of course, that's what we did. We used people. And Billy Graham's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, and another member of his staff, John Mitchell, who both of those went to prison for the Watergate affair. And both of them said, yes, we did. We did use him. And Mr. Graham himself he didn't deny it. When we talked about that, I remember he put his arms out over the couch and he said, I knew what I'd said to the president. I knew what he'd said to me. But when I saw all those memos circulating in the background, I felt like a sheep led to the slaughter. And one of his close advisors told me, said, I think it's very hard for, called him Billy, very hard for Billy to accept how badly Nixon snookered him. So there were some people who thought, well, you shouldn't have written about that. But, of course, I had to write about that. To have left out his relationship with Richard Nixon would have been, the book would have had no credibility.
We're talking about the book, A Prophet with Honor, the Billy Graham story written by William Martin, and it's just released, updated and released, and so it's a fresh insight. But as Bill has said, he's been on this story for some 40 years or so. And Bill, I want to talk about one other area. You mentioned that you were preaching by age 14. Obviously, a lot of people looked at, well, what was it about his preaching? It seemed kind of simplistic. You know how to put a message together. You've studied religion over the years. What was it about maybe Billy's approach or preaching style or just his message that was so effective?
You are correct in saying that it was simplistic, and he knew that. And he, one of the things that he and others told me says, Billy believes that if you put the cookies on the lower shelf, the children will get it, and if the children will get it, everybody else will understand it too. There was a preacher from Los Angeles whose name I can't call up just this moment, but he told me, he says, I think the reason people believe in Billy Graham and believe the message he preaches is because they know that he himself is a believer. But he also had a kind of charismatic appeal. I'm not implying that this was supernatural, although there are people who say, well, it was a supernatural gift for him. But when he asked people to come forward, he had a kind of attractive power. One of his associates who was back with him in Youth for Christ said, I was a better preacher, and everybody knew it. And I think, looking back, I think that's probably true. He was seen as a better preacher than Billy Graham. But he said, if we would go and preach together in one night, I'd get 15, and the next night he'd get 35, or I'd maybe get 120, and he'd get 170. He said, Billy Graham had the gift of the invitation. But, of course, over the years, just the fact that he became famous, then people trusted him. They wanted to respond to the invitation when Billy Graham offered it, and they wanted, you know, and when Just As I Am began to play, and there was that attraction. But he could be, at his best, he was a terrific preacher. But a lot of his sermons were, I don't know, as even people in the organization say, they were rather ordinary. But he believed them.
We're talking about A Prophet with Honor, the Billy Graham story. It's the just recently released updated edition of this authoritative biography of Billy Graham, written by William Martin, who is a senior fellow for religion and public policy at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston, and a well-known speaker and author, and we're honored to talk with him today here on Faith Radio. William, we, of course, have a connection to Dr. Graham because he served as president of Northwestern Schools at the time it was called then for a few years, and was the first voice heard on the air when our radio ministry began. But he was kind of a reluctant college president. Talk a little bit about his ministry in the late 40s.
Well, he was working with Youth for Christ, and his association with Youth for Christ, which was an organization begun around, well, in the last years of the and just after World War II, it was designed to have something for service people, servicemen, and mostly men, but also other young people to come on, particularly on Saturday nights, to have something to do besides go out and drink or go to brothels. And it turned out to be one of the largest, most important youth movements of that era. And Billy Graham pretty quickly rose to be the main spokesman for it. And as a result of that, one of the key Youth for Christ gatherings or regular gatherings was in Minneapolis, perhaps in St. Paul. I think it was Minneapolis, though. But Dr. Riley, William Bell Riley, the founder, who was a great personal, you know, a great figure at the time, wanted Billy Graham, says, when I die, I want you to come and be head of Northwestern. Be the president. And he said, oh, I don't think I'm so good at that. And when he was, Riley pointed his crooked finger at Billy Graham and said, if I die within the next year, you must say you'll do that. And Billy Graham said, oh, okay, I'll do that. And he did die within the next year. And so Billy Graham was kind of stuck keeping his word. He didn't particularly want to do it. His wife, Ruth, never moved to Minneapolis, but he was not a natural administrator, and he knew that, and the people working for him knew it. But he was a national figure, and he was getting a lot of attention for Northwestern. The attendance soared or rose significantly, and of course the profile lifted, and before too long, when his ministry, his evangelistic ministry, just got was taking so much of his time, he resigned about 1950, I think. And but he did then found his that's where Billy Graham Evangelistic Association was incorporated, because the treasurer also was handling became the treasurer for the BGEA. And that's why for all these years, even though Mr. Graham spent very little time there, that for many, many years, decades, if you wanted to write to Billy Graham, you just write to Billy Graham, Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's all the address you need.
That's right. It's all the address you need, yeah. Well, you know, it was interesting, too, that group of guys I know you talk about there, and there's so much about his life that we could cover, and we won't get to nearly all of it, but they got together, these young, good-looking guys, all determined to preach, and they wanted to do crusades, and they organized some ground rules, I think, in Modesto. Just say a bit about, you know, the those incorporating principles.
Yes. Billy Graham and his team, George Beverly Shea and Cliff Barrows, and I can see the man.
T.W., I suppose, Wilson.
It wasn't T.W., I think it was his brother.
Okay, Grady. Grady,
right, yeah. Right. In any case, the four of them were, they were having a successful gathering, a successful revival then in Modesto, California, and they've been having a lot of success, and Billy very wisely, knowing he was always interested in the history of revivalists before him, and he said, boys, it looks like God has something special set out for us. Let's go off to our rooms and make a list of the things that have caused other evangelistic ministries to run aground and brought them low and embarrassed everyone. And so they went off for a while, and they all tell the same story. We came back, and the list was pretty, it's not too surprising. And so they talked about that there was sex, money, working against the local preachers, or saying, oh, you should follow me and not them. Send me your money because I'm better. And also stretching their statistics. It was called evangelistically speaking, when they were counting arms and legs instead of heads when they reported about their results. And so as a result of that, they decided that they would not have dine in a restaurant, ride in a car alone, be in an office with the door closed with any woman not part of their immediate family. And that particular rule has kept them out of so many problems over the years. And when occasionally it's violated, that person leaves the organization very quickly, and it's not violated. It's violated only rarely. They said that instead of coming into towns and saying, hey, send me your money because I'm a better preacher than your preacher, who is soft on whatever, they began to cooperate with the local ministers, and eventually that worked, and pretty quickly that worked into when a person would come forward, the decision card would be sent to, those people would be sent into local churches. So it was not helping his ministry as much as it was helping the local churches. They accepted whatever the attendance figure was given by, usually by the police or some organization that did that sort of thing regularly, even when they knew that they had more people there than the report showed. And I've seen that happen, as a matter of fact. And also, another one was money. A revivalist at that time would have a big love offering toward the end of the revival, and Billy decided that was a picture was taken of him after leaving Atlanta. He was getting in a car, and he had big sacks of money, and that picture went all over the country, made him look like he was just preaching for money. And he said, we're just going to – he talked with business people, put themselves on a salary that was actually significantly lower than he had been making with the love offerings. So those four things kept the BGEA and kept Billy Graham from the kinds of scandal that have brought other ministries low and had done that before. So it was really real wisdom. It's known as the Modesto Manifesto.
William, you mentioned about cooperation with local ministries and churches. That has always kind of been a hallmark of the Graham organization and Billy himself, right, in terms of cooperation racially, theologically, and some criticism to that. Speak to that issue a bit.
Yes, it's true. I'll just go right to the place where it was most dramatic. He had accepted most of the people who were inviting him to give his crusades, as they were being called in, were evangelicals, conservatives, and fundamentalists, more conservative than evangelicals. And when Billy Graham started and accepting the invitation from Presbyterians and Methodists, evangelicals were people like Carl F. H. Henry, and all the evangelical movement had started by saying, we need to be quit being so restrictive and saying, you can't be part of our circle unless you check all of these boxes. We need to preach the gospel, and then we can work on those other things after we have people accepting the gospel. And that was Billy's own spirit, too. He always had an expansive spirit and wanted to bring more people in rather than shut them out. But when he accepted the invitation of the Protestant Council of Churches to hold a summer-long crusade in New York City, many fundamentalists just broke with him and said, you're trafficking with the devil. You know, this is the Protestant Council of Churches belongs to the American Council of Church, or the National Council of Churches, which belongs to the World Council of Churches, which is headed up by the Antichrist. And so he lost a lot of support then. Gradually, it moved on to Sir over the years, maybe in the mid-80s is when it really started taking on. He began to accept Catholics as not only to send the decision cards to Catholic churches, but to allow Catholic nuns and priests to serve as counselors at the revivals. And that was really hard for a lot of people to take. But Billy Graham, just as I indicated, he just continually widened the circle. And he came under criticism for that, but he stuck with that.
Yeah. You know, I was interested just in reading it. I guess maybe I'd kind of forgotten about it, but in those formative years of his preaching that, you know, the growing influence of communism after World War II, Russia developing nuclear weapons, and then the founding of the modern state of Israel, those were a couple of kind of key influencers, weren't they, in his ministry over the years?
Oh, yes. Well, in the early years, he was the Russia, the communists, and the USSR just really didn't want to have anything to do with Billy Graham because he was really a leading anti-communist figure. Over the years, not only did he say, no, free market capitalism is not the only economic system under which Christianity can exist, that you can have Christianity under any kind of system, even though it may be more difficult to observe. And gradually, and this is something that I wrote, I think, four chapters about in the book, that Billy Graham, by being very polite, courteous, was able to move into countries behind the Iron Curtain, starting with Poland and Hungary, and moving on. And so he was able to move from having a semi-secret gatherings with a local Baptist church, but with the approval of the state, until eventually he was holding great services in state-run, in state-owned stadiums, and his sermons broadcast over the state media. Redounded to the benefit of other Protestant and Catholic churches, because Billy Graham was saying Christians, and this in Russia particularly, he told them, Christians and religious people are not your enemies. You do not have to be afraid. They are some of your best citizens. The United States will have difficulty with any country that oppresses people for their religion. And you need to widen the boundaries of religious freedom. And that I think he had a major impact on that. In 1992, he held a, even in 1986 when I was first working on the book, I was told Billy knows that he will never be able to preach in Moscow openly. But in 1992, it had progressed to the point that he held a revival in the indoor Olympic Stadium. 3,000 churches were able to participate, and the final service had 50,000 people in the stadium and 20,000 people watching outside, and the Russian Army Chorus sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
What a legacy. I was privileged to be a part of the Amsterdam 2000 conference, and I'm just thinking here as our time runs out, you look over the his you know, record of activities and accomplishments. You know, what maybe stands out to you as having the greatest impact? Was it large crusades or his use of technology or influence? What comes to mind for you?
All of those things come to mind, of course. The crusades, the conferences where he drew evangelical leaders from all over the world and said, if you work together, he said, like where Elijah thought, I am left, and he told them, no, get together and work in conferences in Berlin and Lausanne. But I think he was probably proudest of the Amsterdam conferences. Those were in 1983, 1986, and 2000. I went to the one in 1986, and it's a high point in my life. But people ask me all the time, who's going to be the next Billy Graham? And I say there's no single person can be that, in part because evangelical Christianity is largely, in significant measure, because what he did, so large, so diverse, so multifaceted that no one person can dominate it, no matter how much talent or dedication. But there'll be thousands of people, tens of thousands of people trained in those conferences in Amsterdam and then in regional, what they call mini Amsterdams after that, who will become, as some of them said, little Billy Grahams. And he said to them in the conference I went to, you are my successors. It's important to remember Billy Graham's not an office in the Christian church that has to be filled like the Pope or the Archbishop of Canterbury. There will be people carrying on the work inspired by him, and that's what was important. That's what was important to him. So that was the legacy he wanted. I think it's the legacy that will perhaps last beyond.
He could have been a politician or an actor or a salesman, any number of things. But he truly had a heart to share the gospel, didn't he? I guess that would be a takeaway all of us could learn a lesson from, right? Being willing to just share the gospel message. It seemed like whenever he had opportunity to speak with anybody, the conversation always ended up back at the gospel, no matter where they wanted to start.
That's right. I close the new edition by saying that that he was the best who ever lived at what he did. If you look at what he accomplished, that he, to quote scripture, he was a workman who needeth not to be ashamed.
William, thank you for the half a lifetime of research that you put into this to really sum up well Billy Graham's life and ministry. The book is called A Prophet with Honor, The Billy Graham Story. It's just been updated and released, and we're honored to have with us today William Martin, the writer of this great new work, updated work, I should say. He serves, among other things, as a senior fellow for religion and public policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Bill, thank you for your work on this and for sharing with us today here on Faith Radio.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be with you.